Welcome to Rocket Talk. I'm Justin Landon, and on this episode, I am joined, after quite a bit of scheduling challenges, the world-famous book smugglers Anna Grillo and Thea James. Anna is a Brazilian expat in the United Kingdom who works in translation by day. Thea lives in New York and works in publishing. By their powers combined, they are the Hugo-nominated book smugglers. They can be found blogging on their tremendously popular site, writing for Kirkus, or most recently, editing and publishing short stories. Welcome.
Hello.
Thank you. Hi.
I'm really excited to have gotten both of you on the show simultaneously. Have you ever been on a podcast together?
No.
Although we're very good at talking at the same time.
Yes, definitely.
Well, I will chalk this up as an accomplishment then. Anybody who's had you solo is going to be jealous that I got you both together. So anyway, thanks for being here. The crazy thing is you two have actually been blogging since 2008, which in terms of blog years makes you like 1,000 years old, I guess, because blogs, very ephemeral. How do you guys maintain the energy to blog for that long? Because I struggle.
I don't know.
I don't know. I think it definitely helps that there are two of us. And, you know, we can help share that workload when I'm feeling super bogged down with real life, or I have a cold like I do right now, or, you know, things are stressful at work. Anna's there to pick up the pieces and vice versa, I think. So that helps. And also it helps because we're both really excited and, you know, dorky and nerdy about the same titles. So that's always kind of fun to be able to share that with someone else.
And I think we also are, you know, equally excited about blogging and about doing this as well. It's not like we never have any fights or have any problems with each other. And it's just really, I think it's really cool, this actually, Thea, and in case you don't know, that we're like on the same wavelength most of the time. It's like, yeah.
No, it's so true. I completely agree. You're my constant, Anna.
Oh, I know.
Did you know each other before you started blogging together?
More or less. We met on a Lost forum, you know, geeking out about the TV show Lost. And I think we had known each other for about 1 year, more or less.
Yeah, about a year. And we exchanged private messages. I mean, we were on a larger forum and then made our way to like a super secret sub forum. And then, we private messaged each other a lot and we had a lot of crazy theories, like a probably almost 70 page theory of Desmond, and how he is the key to all of Lost, which was completely wrong. But we both had the same obsessive personalities and we both discovered that we loved books too. So one day Anna was like, hey, do you want to start a blog with me? And I was like, sure, why not?
It's interesting that you met on television. And do you have time for television anymore? Because I know as I blog and read and just to keep up on.
Hello, do you know how many TV shows I watch?
Yeah, Anna's more crazy.
I think
she watches everything
regularly,
and like binge watches everything too. Like
I'm binge watching Leverage as we speak.
Yeah, I have Homeland going on in the background. Although I'm probably gonna have to rewatch that. We're very good at multitasking, I think, and again, we both have really obsessive personalities, and it helps that we both like a lot of the same things because. Then we can talk about them. It's crazy.
Yes, a little bit.
So one of the things that I face as a blogger and a writer of nonfiction and reviews, and like I've never burned out on reading. Like I love to read, and I read voraciously regardless of whether I'm going to write about it or not. But as a reviewer, and although you both write other things too, predominantly you write reviews. Do you find yourself exhausted by the review process? I guess what I find myself exhausted by the review process, so I'm so blown away that you don't.
Well, personally speaking, I feel like I have changed my style. Just in terms of how I structure my reviews. I think I used to structure it a little bit more organized before, and now I feel like I let it flow, if you know what I mean. I just write the way I want to talk about the book. And I feel like this has helped me in keeping up with it without losing interest.
Yeah. And for me, I think it's not that I've lost interest in or feel burned out by reviewing. I love talking about books. It's always the time question, you know, finding the time to actually sit down and write a coherent review. It's hard sometimes. But it's definitely slowed down this year. I went to grad school, you know, while I was doing this blog. So there's that. I don't think there's enough to ever, I can be dead tired at 2 a.m. and I will still try to write that review because I like doing it that much. And you make time for the things you care about.
I can vouch that this is true because sometimes I wake up and she's still awake writing stuff.
Time management.
Dude, what are you doing?
I think you like what you like, and if you're passionate about something, you'll do it. And we're both very good about that, I think.
Yeah, I think so as well.
And obviously, you have over the years added things to the blog to kind of provide new and interesting content. You know, you do your joint reviews, and then you've done, you know, your In Dialogue series. You do your Smuglevus thing every holiday season. And now you've brought out the book Smugglers Publishing, which is obviously a huge new endeavor. I'm curious if you have created some of these things, you know, putting the book Smugglers Publishing aside for just a second. Have you created some of these things to just give yourselves new things to pursue, like constantly chasing, you know, the next fun thing to keep pushing the envelope?
Is it the next fun thing or is it an attempt at world domination? That's what we usually ask ourselves. No, both of us, seriously, we have these State of the Union meetings, I think once or twice a year now. And we always ask ourselves, you know, what can we be doing? What can we do next? What can be better? And a lot of our features have kind of flowed out of that organically. I think we have, you know, we both have these weird half-baked ideas. And when we finally force ourselves to sit down and talk them out and set long-term goals for ourselves, that's where those things come from, like Old School Wednesdays or, you know, SFF in Conversation. And Anna's really usually a great driving force for that. I just help implement it.
I don't know. I'm trying to figure out whether it's because we need to keep ourselves interested, or if I'm going to say, I think we are both ambitious as well. And I think we want to do more and better all the time. And I think that we try to do that in a way that we think will be helpful and useful to the people who read our blog and, you know, to everybody. So this is where Old School Wednesdays came from as well, because, you know, we saw an interest from our readers in talking about older titles, and we just wrote it. And SFF in Conversation was something as well that was born out of this need to interact and to give back to the community and to bring people to talk about the things that matter to us and to the people that we know read us. Yes, Claire?
Yeah, completely agree.
More or less, yes. Yeah. But you know, world domination.
Yes. First and foremost.
Yes. Evil blogging agenda.
I like it. If you've created all these other things sort of based on what your readers were, what you were hoping your readers would like, but what also interested you, now you've gone and created Book Smugglers Publishing, which released its first story today, October 7th. And you have changed the dynamic at the fundamental level of what the blog is doing in a lot of ways, because you've gone from a blog that is self-creating content and putting it out there in the world, essentially for the masses for nothing. And now you are bringing in writers to produce content on the site, in this case fiction, and you are paying them a pro rate for their fiction. And this is really, I think, fundamentally changing the blog in a lot of ways, right? Like it's changing the entire structure of it and how you view it as a professional enterprise. Not that you haven't always viewed it as a professional enterprise, but it is actually now a professional enterprise as you are paying people. What made you decide to go that route, to make that big, huge jump?
You want to take that, Anna?
Do you know, it's actually a true story that we hadn't even discussed this. And then we had one of our meetings in May, and then we were just talking about what came next, and we both just said, what about short stories? And then on that same day, we put everything together.
Right. And, you know, it's so interesting, too, because you always, and maybe not so much in our industry, although, or in our genre anyway, but you always hear about bloggers who are also, you know, moonlighting as fiction writers, or bloggers like, you know, Sarah Wendell of Smart Bitches, Trashy Books and Romance, publishing nonfiction books, or even, you know, yourself, Justin and Jared, you know, collecting nonfiction articles and putting out another nonfiction title. I think the real shift for us here is the fiction aspect, and the fact that we're not the writers, that we are the ones who are publishing, the arbiters, I guess, or the gatekeepers that want to choose the stories that we tell instead of just commenting on the stories that are being told by others. And I think a lot of that experience definitely comes from editing SpecFic 2013. And also just because we love stories, and we feel like there is this sort of dearth in the marketplace for diverse fantasy, diverse science fiction, diverse horror, for all ages. And we, you know, we're passionate about bringing that sort of storytelling and those new voices to the forefront. I mean, we always not complain about it, but we always talk about it on the blog, and, you know, with a lot of the big new releases that we always see, this is just kind of a way for us to, you know, to shift that paradigm and bring it out, you know, ourselves.
Yeah.
You mentioned for all ages, and I always felt like that was one of the most interesting things about the Book Smuggler's point of view. There are other sites, of course, that review fiction of all ages, but I always thought that the two of you interacted with YA and middle grade and adult fiction in a really I think you came at it from a really good place, a really good angle. I always found it very interesting the way you addressed each of the different levels. I hate to say reading levels, because they're often genres as much as they are reading levels, but
right.
That you dealt with them in that way. And as we talk about short fiction, certainly within science fiction and fantasy, there are a lot of markets that are adult markets, but I don't think we see a lot of young adult style short fiction stories, at least in the markets that we intersect with most often. Do you think, as you talk about it, that's one of the things you really want to get at, is a more young adult, middle grade point of view?
We do. We actually do want to do that. And I think you were right. I don't think we see a lot of short stories published in the sort of format that we are doing now. We see a lot of YA short stories in anthologies.
Right. Or like those interstitials between, like, the Divergent stories, where you'll have, you know, like, they're more promotional tools to, you know, kind of sell the next book.
Yeah, kind of like tying. Yeah, things right. like that. Yeah, that's true. But, you know, for us, it's not really anything special that we do. We read all of those middle grade, YA, and adult. It's just a good story is a good story is a good story.
Right.
And this is where we are coming from in terms of publishing as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's even in our submission guidelines. And I think it's true, you know, a good story is ageless. Good speculative fiction is ageless. And I think you can see that with any number of titles that are considered classics, or, you know, cornerstones of science fiction or fantasy right now. And we kind of want to bring that to short stories as well, and provide a platform for those voices. I mean, in part, that's why we're debuting with Hunting Monsters, which is ostensibly a young adult story.
Exactly.
I would agree that it is. That's kind of why I asked the question, because Hunting Monsters, and we should mention that your theme for the first batch of submissions, and I believe you have four stories that you're going to publish within that theme, was fairy tales, right?
Yes, fairy tale retellings.
Right.
And fairy tales, sort of by their nature, have a strong didactic element, which is often associated with young adult. And so I'm curious, as we see the other stories, if they sort of fit within that.
Well, they have a lesson if they are in their original forms, but ours are you know, a retelling. And in the retelling, the writer has more freedom to expand on the story itself and develop the characters more and the story more, and not go via that route of moralizing or having a lesson told by the end of the tale. And you probably notice by reading the ones that we are publishing that that's certainly the case. I don't think our YA short stories are moralizing anyway. I don't think so.
So we have, Hunting Monsters is definitely what I would consider YA. Mrs. Yaga, which is coming out next month, that certainly is YA. And we have one middle grade title on the list called The Astronomer Who Met the North Wind, which, is middle grade. So for younger readers, although, you know, it can be read by anyone, I think, of any age, I think maybe Mrs. Yaga is the one that comes closest to giving a moral lesson, but it's more of all of them are more coming of age stories. You know, it's about self-empowerment or understanding what it means to grow up and, you know, coming to terms with secrets in your family, for example, with Hunting Monsters, or believing in yourself and your ability to do something. It's not so much the traditional fairy tale retelling or the fairy tale mold where you need to follow certain rules in order to get rewarded with that happy ending. Go ahead.
I would actually argue that our right from exactly those things that the originals were trying to do.
Exactly. Yeah. The fairy tales, that's the loose genre, or, you know, the loose umbrella definition. I mean, I think the important thing is the subversive part of it. All of the stories that we picked, and we picked stories from, you know, around the world, there's all this element, every single one of them has an element of subversion to them, where they take a twist on that inherent didacticism that you associate with a traditional Western fairy tale.
Exactly.
Well, and I have read Hunting Monsters, which came out today, and I actually had a chance to read it last week. And as I read it, I did take a lesson away, which is if there's a locked door, there's probably something in there that nobody wants you to see. is it Red Riding Hood? Is that the right fairy tale that's being retold here? Like, I'm not really sure.
It's actually three. It has elements of Snow White, Beauty and the Beast, and Red Riding Hood.
Mm-hmm. I'm processing that now. I'm like thinking about Beauty and the Beast and Snow White.
For me personally, the Beauty and the Beast part of it, I think, is the most interesting, because it's such a beloved, you know, love story, really, from Disney to, you know, the original, I guess the original French. But in this version, I don't know, it makes more sense. It's an interesting approach when you think about it.
I know, right?
Where this woman, where this young woman actually is given to a beast, you know?
Pay for something. And it never occurred to me to read the story that way. And I thought that was so brilliant what S.L. Gwynn did to that story.
Absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree. I think that was definitely what, and I love the fact too that, so we do have those different fairy tale elements that influence the story, but really the story itself is not really, it is about the mother character, but it's told through the eyes of her daughter, who's learning these things about her mother for the first time. So really the relationship at the core of this story is the mother-daughter relationship, which you don't see in any of those other fairy tales. And I think that's what really attracted, well, me to it anyway.
Yeah, definitely.
So you talk about world domination, and you talk about the story Hunting Monsters and this theme of fairy tales. As you look out of the Book Smugglers publishing empire, what do you plan to do with these stories beyond publishing them on your website?
Well, we are also publishing them as ebooks, available on several retailers online. And each ebook will have not only the story, but also inspirations and influences, a Q&A that we put together with the writer for each of those books, and also the cover art, which we are really proud of.
Right. And in some scenarios, too, we have our next story that's publishing next Tuesday, actually.
No.
Oh, wait, nope. The Tuesday after, thank God. The Tuesday after, it is from a Japanese fable, I guess, not really a fairy tale, called Hachikaduki. And that's a story that many people probably have never heard of or have read before. And it's fascinating. It's about this princess or a woman who has to wear a pot on her head that covers, you know, almost her entire face. So in that instance, that ebook also contains the original fable, translated from Japanese. And, you know, we'll try to do that as much as possible if there's a preferred retelling or a preferred original source fable that is, you know, perhaps not accessible to most readers.
Yes.
I like that a lot because I feel like, especially in fairy tale telling, obviously the source material is hugely important, which proves out by the fact that I didn't recognize all three of the fairy tales within Hunting Monsters. I only got part of the context, and the context is pretty key to take the most you can away from it, I think.
Could be. But I think, I also think that the story is really good on its own.
Yeah.
Even if it's not really, if you don't see all the elements of the fairy tale, I think the story stands really well on its own.
Right. It's really interesting. So I think, was it last year or the year before, Philip Pullman put out, you know, his version of Tales from the Brothers Grimm. Yeah. They're all like very, very short. And Anna, I think you read some of these too, right? They're very, very short, you know, classically told fairy tales. And he has an essay in that book where he talks about, you know, the structure of a fairy tale and the narrative of a fairy tale and how they have to have these very clipped, or not clipped, but, you know, a very distinct cadence, a beginning, a middle, and end. And I think many of our stories have that sort of feel. Certainly Hunting Monsters, you know, follows that sort of pattern, at least, or, you know, that narrative, that traditional fairy tale narrative. But I mean, again, the subversion part is huge. And I think these stories stand well on their own, but when you're reading them, you're conscious that you're reading a fairy tale. I don't know if I'm articulating that well enough.
No, I agree with that.
Yeah.
I think The Astronomer Who Met the North Wind is also very good at end as
yes,
well.
Yes, absolutely.
Sounds like a proper old style fairy tale, but it's anything but.
Right. I think Mrs. Yaga as well, the same. And even The Muscle Eater, which is you know, a Maori fable, I guess, or origin story. I think the one that doesn't fit as well is the Japanese one, again, from Yukimi Ogawa, and she's a Japanese author who lives in Japan, and it has a totally different sort of feel to it, but I think it's still, I don't know, I'm just saying words now. It feels like a fairy tale, but it doesn't at the same time. It has a very different sort of style, and it's more science fiction, I think, than any other story on the list, which gets me so excited.
Yeah, I actually recently just read Phantasm Japan, which was a short story collection from Haikusoru about Japan, I guess. It's supposed to be a fantasy anthology, although there's a lot of science fiction elements in it too. And I did find that the Japanese stories, or at least the ones that were written originally, or were written in originally in Japanese by Japanese writers, had a much different feel to them generally. Like, even mm-hmm. if they were, they just, I feel like a lot of our short stories in this country, I've heard it referred to as the Clarion effect.
Right.
Which is like a lot of the short stories that are published in our markets right now are built around this Clarion model of storytelling. And they're all very similar to one another, I feel like, even if the stories are completely different, so the milieus are completely different, the characters are completely different, there's a structure to the stories that's very familiar.
Yep.
And it's neat to get stories that are not published in this country originally or aren't written from a, you know, that point of view, that you get that original structure that kind of just comes at you in a different way.
I completely agree. And I think, Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. And I think that's why it's so important for us. I mean, even with our cover artists, like, we are really trying to find voices from other countries and other places. If there's something interesting, I mean, I will say straight up that, you know, working on In Her Head and Her Eyes, which is the Japanese story, that was probably the hardest one to edit. And Anna, you can agree or disagree, but the most time consuming in any case. But I think ultimately it's worth it because you do end up with this different experience. And, you know, it's something new and exciting to read.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I'm curious about your submission process as you went through it. You mentioned earlier that there are bloggers who write, and we all know that there are lots of aspiring writers in the blogging community. There are lots of aspiring, there are generally just a lot of aspiring writers. I'm very curious about, I mean, how many submissions did you all get as a first time market paying a CIFWA pro rate?
We got 500.
Yeah. Sweet mother of God.
And we read them all.
Within like less than 2 months.
Yep.
You guys are going to have to bring on Slush for this next. You're going to need a Slush reader for this next round.
No, because I want to read all of them.
Right, exactly. I mean, the good thing is too, like, if we're moving quickly and we can sort of divide and conquer, and I can say, you know, she'll point out the ones that I should immediately read or vice versa. I remember really early on when we got one of the stories that we actually ended up publishing, I finished reading, I was like, you gotta read this, Anna, read this one now. So that's really good. And I don't know, it's kind of exciting to go through some of these. I mean, even the stories that we didn't end up publishing, I remember we got a submission from an author who said this was literally her first story. And it was too short, and, you know, there were certain issues, but it was freaking memorable and fantastic. What? And I would, there's such good stuff. I think for almost all of the stories, I mean, not all of them, but a good majority of them, there's some kernel of wonder in there that, you know, makes you excited to read it and to discover it. Even, and it kind of, it was heartbreaking. We wanted to publish so many stories, but we couldn't. And we even broke our, you know, rule. We said we're only going to publish three, and we're ending up publishing six. So.
And you know what is really cool, Justin, is that we read all of those stories independently, and then we picked exactly the same ones in the end.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Is there a story that one of you was like, I want to publish this, and the other one was like, no way.
Yes.
Anna. Just one. The other ones, they were all exactly the same.
Yeah. No, that's true. There was one story that Anna really liked and that I just really did not like. So, and
yeah.
But that's okay. They can resubmit. Yeah.
Fine.
I try to imagine what it would be like if Jared Sharon and I decided to do an actual collection of short stories together, and we would not. You all clearly have more similar tastes than I think I could have ever imagined having with anybody else, if that's the case. If there was really only one super divisive story, I'm very impressed with the two of you. Did you, each of you actually read all 500, or is it kind of one of those things where if one person said this is like no good, the other one could just kind of glance at it and just say, yeah, I trust you? Or did you actually both read all 500? Come on.
Anna read more than I did. She read every single one. And there were probably, I don't know, 25 stories, something like that, where she was like, this is just, you know, it's not very good. Probably don't waste your time on it. And I would probably skim a little bit of it and then, you know, defer to her opinion. And that kind of breaks my heart to do, but gosh, I need more time. If someone could give me a time turner, I would read all the stories in the world immediately.
But at least one of us did read all of them. I read all of them in the totality.
And, okay, so I'll ask you then, Anna, among these 500 stories, on a scale of 1 to 10, what would you say was the average quality of submission?
Oh, I was amazed. It was actually really good. I would say that the average would be around 5, 6, with quite a few above that.
Yeah.
So like, yeah, I would even the middling story was like something you could read and enjoy for what it was.
Readable, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. They were fine, yeah. Yes, but I will admit that I was super surprised, and I was amazed by the quality. Do you know what else, Justin? We've got so many stories. You know, I know that our call for submission said it very, very openly that we wanted subversive and diverse and feminist, but we did get those. We did get a lot of amazing stories with all sorts of characters and all sorts of you know, and also from authors. And I was very surprised at the amount of, we got quite a few stories from India. It blew my mind away. And sometimes I just think about how sometimes, you know, we talk about these things online and how editors go, oh, we don't really receive that many diverse stories. And I'm like, are you really even then making the right call?
Yeah.
Because, you know, we put it out there. We contacted a few people directly. We try to spread the word, you know, amongst people that talk about diversity, and on Tumblr as well. I focus quite a lot on doing publicity on Tumblr to get to attract people to send stories. And then we got what we asked for. It's there. It's out there.
The Book Smuggler's mission statement. It's out there. I like it.
Yeah, and that actually connects with our next call, which is first contact.
Which I actually really like this is the thing. I think you guys are doing a really fantastic job of the way you're framing your submissions and your themes. I think sometimes when you get into themes, people get too into the weeds a little bit.
Yeah.
With trying to be too specific. What y'all have basically done is taken two, so thus far, like, huge subgenres or genres, if you will, of story type, and just basically said, do something unique within this mm-hmm. yeah. very tried and true story idea.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that brings out something.
I think it has definitely done so in our first call, and we have our fingers crossed for the second one. And now we already have a theme for our third call next year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be awesome.
So I'm not going to ask you to give me any names, but I am curious. Did you get anybody submitting a story when you were like, they actually submitted a story? Like, was it?
Yes. Sorry. Yeah, we did. We got at least, you know, I would say five authors who submitted a story. And it was one of those, holy crap, we have a submission from XXX. So, that's amazing. That's, you know, one of the most legitimizing moments when we're looking through those submissions. Like, holy crap, this author submitted to us. I can die happy now.
And you might have had to say no to him.
Yes. There was that, too. I mean, that's hard, but I mean, we tried, oh man, it was, you know, we did pick a lot. Our shortlists were basically identical, with a few deviations here and there and that one really divisive story. But other than that, I mean, we really tried to pick the stories that would reflect the sort of program that we want to put forward. So that's not automatically accepting a big author just because they're a big author. It was, and you know, maybe that's not a good move, but I think it's something that we're passionate about, and we really wanted to take care and pick authors who represented, you know, these diverse voices whose stories were really the best of the best. And you know, we're from different parts of the world. I think that is very important for us.
Definitely.
All right. So, speaking of relatively, I shouldn't even say relatively anymore. Speaking of big authors, before we decided to record the show, we were all in the process or about to read Ancillary Sword by Anne Leckie, who is just coming off what is probably...
Today.
It just came out today. But it is,
yep.
It is coming... Anne Leckie is coming off of what is probably the most impressive single awards run of any author or book basically ever, having won just about every major genre award there is.
And also double 10 rate from us.
Yes, the ever important double 10. And it's one of those, Ancillary Justice was a book that got a glowing review from both me and Liz Burke, which is, doesn't happen that often.
Unprecedented.
So anyway, as I was thinking about this, and something I wanted to talk to you about was Ancillary Sword is obviously a book that we're all looking at saying, this wonderful first novel of Ancillary Justice was Anne Leckie's debut novel. You know, can she follow it up? I mean, this is always the fear with a huge hit like that, especially one that is a trilogy from the beginning, is what's the second book going to do? And I think there's a lot of curiosity out there about whether she's been successful, to what degree she's been successful with this second novel. Now, I believe you both gave it a double 10 again, did you not?
Yes. We did.
Yeah.
Well, I posted a review today as well, and it was not as it's a good review. I mean, I think it's a very good book, but for me, I felt like there was a little something that was missing from the first book, and I would be curious to get your response to, before you talk about why you loved it, I would just be curious to get your response to what I struggled with. And
sure.
The first book, Answer, just had a lot of energy to it to me, and I think it was driven by what was a revenge storyline. And it gave like a lot of energy to the book. In the second novel, it's much more reserved as a novel. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't make it a worse novel. It just makes it a novel that's not as fun to read. And so I felt myself having to work a little bit harder to get through it.
I think it depends on what kinds of stories do you like. Because, for example, I was thinking about this, and I actually think that Ancillary Sword could be called a coming of age story, right? Because of everything that Breck goes through in this book, even though she hasn't been a ship for a period of time that predates the actual events of this book here, I think this is where she's actually, because she's done with the revenge. So she needs to kind of start over, and at the same time that she needs to go through new things, like she needs to go and talk to Lieutenant On's sister, and she needs to to become a captain of her own ship and deal with all of that at the same time that she's just stranded in this small planet with all of these skirmishes. And I think a coming of age is a good maybe descriptor for this story. And I personally love coming of age stories. And I think that's maybe why I loved it so much.
It's certainly a coming of age story. I don't know if I would call it a coming of age story. I mean, I can definitely see where you're coming from, Anna, with that. But I feel like this book really spoke to me because it's so intimate. And you're absolutely right, Justin. Like we're not doing this. There isn't this pressing need for revenge. There isn't that forward thrust. And there isn't that discovery aspect of, I mean, yes, there is some discovery, but there isn't this discovery aspect of, you know, the flipping between time narrative, which is, you know, it's exciting in itself. That narrative structure is so exciting. In this one, it's more intimate. It's more quiet. You're with Breck as it is now. And I think being that much closer to her / its thoughts, I think that's what was so fascinating to me. You finally get more of a sense of how alien actually, but revenge is such a human emotion, right? And we can all understand that motivation. We can all understand Breck's story in that first book. In this one, it's slightly different because there are different thoughts and feelings, different driving factors here. And I think that's what kind of drew me to it. That intimacy, but also that alien sort of reveal of this entity, of this mind, of this person thing. I don't know what to call. I don't know the noun. And also, I'm sorry, my brain is mush today. I also think, though, I mean, on the negative side, Ancillary Sword is very much a middle novel. It did have a little bit of heavy-handedness, but there's so many promising threads. I think the narrative was so strong, and I really love this world and these characters so much that it was... Sometimes you review based on your gut versus what your brain says. Or, you know, when you're picking like a basketball bracket or something, like there's your heart bracket and your head bracket. And for this, I just went with what it felt like to me, which was a 10. And that's not very scientific, but some books make you break the rules. And I think Ancillary Justice, Ancillary Sword are books that do that.
I challenge your thesis now. No, I think I actually really like Anna's point about it being a coming of age story. I think if you read it, if you read it within that context in your head, I think I would respond to it maybe a little bit differently. I also think it's interesting as you describe her as being very alien, because Breck is very alien. And in some ways, it's almost like a first contact story for the reader, because in the first book, you know all that's going on and it's there under the surface, but you're really very focused on the actual plot, right?
Right.
And so you're carried through, the plot is the through line. And the background stuff with the pronouning and the cultural and the cultural appropriation and all of the colonialism that's going on, and then Breck's own interpersonal relationships are all kind of on the back burner because you're focused on the plot through line. And all of that goes away in this book because there really isn't a strong plot through line. If you told me what is the plot of this book, I really struggle to even identify it, because the plot is really about Breck dealing with being a person. And having to actually do people things and solve problems and identify relationships with individuals and come to grips with their own guilt and all of this stuff that she's dealing with. And like, that's the plot, but that's not really a traditional plot. And that's why I compared it to Karen Lord's Best of All Possible Worlds, which was this very social book. It's about, it's science fictional, but it's about personal relationships more than it's about any plot. I think you both have read Best of All Possible Worlds. Is that a comparison that works?
Yes, maybe. Do you know, I still don't know if even though I said this is a coming of age, and even though this is a very personal book and a quiet book, I still don't know if this is really just it, because it's not, right? Because you have the whole thing with the Lord of the, I call her Anakin, because I can never remember.
Anander, Anander Miani.
Anander,
yes,
yeah. Anander. Lord of the Rad.
You know, the whole thing is still happening. There is still the mystery of what's going on, and there's still the different warring sides of Anakin and Ender, and what is beyond the Ghost Gate, and that I felt it was a personal book, but I could feel all of the other threads just spreading.
Right.
And and I think that the third book will be amazing, hopefully.
If it can tie all those together, that's always the fear.
Right. And another thing as well, that you both said this, that how you feel that Breck is very alien, and I actually felt her to be so human in this book. I can see the alien side of it. I can see the not human side, but I still think that I'm still thinking that all the AIs in this world, they are not really things or aliens. They are actually very human, because they have this connection with their lieutenants, and they require touch, and they require communion with people. And Breck always loved songs, and I feel that is in a way very, very human.
Or is that something that's easy for us to project on? I think something that I love about this series is that you, there's always this tendency to sort of either make a killer emotionless robot, right? Like, that is the one extreme, or the other extreme is to, you know, create the robot who has a soul and, you know, anthropomorphize the crap out of it. I like that this doesn't push one of those sides, that this series doesn't do that. And just because an AI needs, you know, attention or forms relationships, does that mean that it's inherently human? Does that mean that it's, I don't have any answers, but maybe that's a facet of the human condition. I still felt like everything that Breck would do, or, you know, trying to attempt these human interactions, just showed how different of a, you know, creature Breck is. And I like that a lot.
Right. That's interesting.
Well, I think there's a lot to be illuminated by watching Breck try to find it, right? And so it makes us look at something that we probably think is that we take for granted, perhaps. And so we,
right.
I mean, I think I learn a lot about what it means to be human by reading about Breck. I'm just not so sure that I think of Breck as being terribly human.
Right.
Which is interesting. And I think the point is great. Like, at the end of the day, this is not a book by itself, right? This is a trilogy. I think one of the challenges, I think the first book did stand on its own pretty well. I felt like it did sort of resolve its big plot with obviously things to continue on. This book, I mean, there's still so much unresolved.
Yeah.
And it's possible that third book is going to be super plot heavy again, like in much the way the first book is, because it kind of has to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because now it kind of already dealt with Breck.
Right.
It's coming of age. Aha. Uh-huh.
Right. Well, this is kind of, you know, this is the setup. This is the setup book. It clearly, I mean, it very much is a middle book. And, you know, it's hard for that to stand on its own. Like, there's this big anticipation, you know, the promise of the next book to deliver big time. But, you know, I believe in Anne Leckie, and this book was fantastic. So I have no doubt that, you know, well, no, I always have doubt, but I hope that she will deliver.
So, question for you too. One of the things that most reviews concentrated on was the gender aspect of the novel, how every single character is addressed as a she. Mm-hmm. And I felt when I was reading the first book that my brain wanted to pin people down. Mm-hmm. And even if they were described as a she, I would try to find things to try and fit them into a terrible binary division. And I felt that reading the second book, I did not do that at all. I just went with the flow. Everybody was a she. I didn't really care. Did you feel any difference between reading the first and the second at all in those terms?
I feel like...
Sorry, Justin, I'm interviewing you too now.
Well, for me, I think it's one of those things that when you start the series, you think a little more about it. Or, you know, I feel like I've already done that warm up in my brain with Ancillary Justice. So I did not, and I really tried consciously not to force things into those binary roles. In the first book, even though that was hard. And in the second one, I definitely think it was much easier to get past that. I do agree with you, Anna.
For me, the first book, I had that experience a little bit at first in the first book that I was trying to gender people. I stopped pretty early on caring. And in the second book, I did not even consider trying to gender people until the character who is the son, that for a reason, because that's the character who is constantly trying to control people around him. And it, to me, it came off as the standard domineering male character who is so insecure that he is constantly putting down others around him. And I had a very hard time gendering that character as anything else but a man, despite the fact that I believe that character is referred to as daughter of the family, and pronoun is she, obviously, as everybody is pronouned as she. And I thought that was very interesting, my reaction to that. I didn't try to gender any other character in the book with the exception of that one, and I could not in my mind think of that character as anything else but a man.
Oh, interesting. I never thought of that character as a man.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But, and Breck, I've never had any trouble. I don't even think of Breck as a man or a woman. It's never even occurred to me to try to gender Breck. I hear a lot of people refer to Breck as her, as though she, as though Breck is a woman. And the body may be female. I have no idea. But have never thought of Breck as a gender, which, and I don't know if my experience is unique in that regard. I it's kind of one of those questions that I would be curious if we took a survey of everybody that had read the book, you know, and who they gendered what in their head, or if they gendered in their head. And and I don't know, I think you do have a really wide range of responses. I will say the only problem I had with the second book versus the first book in terms of just the reading experience was there are a lot of names. So my learning curve going into the second book, I was like, do I know who this person is, or don't I know who this person is? And that was the only real challenge. I do think, given the naming, a dramatis personae, I probably would have been well taken in that book.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the cast call.
Yes.
And maps.
Especially for ancillary material. Especially for those of us that don't read. I mean, I remember when I was a young person and I would read series fiction. You know, like, I was the type that would go into the bookstore and find the one that had five books in the series, start with the first one, and I'd read them through until I was done. And now, especially as a blogger, I never read series that way. I actually very rarely read series at all because I get fatigued by them. But I always have at least a year or two between the series, however long it takes for the next book to come out. Like, I never get to read them back to back. So I always struggle with that, like, name retention thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
We
read a lot of series, I think, but it's that time gap that's killer. So it's nice to have that kind of material.
Yeah, could you imagine reading, like, Steven Erikson with a year between each book?
Or no.
2 years between each book? I'd stab myself.
No.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway, what about you, Anna? Did you have that? What was your experience as you asked us the question? I have to turn it back around and ask you. Is there any character in the two books that you feel like you gendered in your head and you thought of that character that way?
Yes, actually. I have gendered, how do you call it? Saevarden?
Your beloved Saevarden.
Yeah, I wanted to be a girl.
Yeah. Weirdly, I think of Anakin and Ander as female and that is completely wrong because they're, you know, it's a self-splintered entity. But I don't know it for me. That's just, I kind of like this overlord female character in my head that I really try to divorce myself from.
Anna, did you gender anybody as a man in the book or not in your head?
As a man? Not that I can think of.
That's interesting. You know, as we talk about that gendering in your head thing, have you two read Lock In?
No.
Okay. Yeah, that's the new Scalzi novel, and obviously he does not gender his narrator in the story. But of course I gendered it immediately as a man. And of course, like, 70% of readers do, right? Like, men or male or female, it seems like that it's that natural default that he did some kind of poll where it said that women gendered the character as a female, like, I want to say it was 50 to 60% of the time the female reader gendered the protagonist as female, where the man, it was like 100% gendered it as male.
Okay. That's fascinating.
Yeah.
Was Lock In any good?
I quite liked it. I'm not a big Scalzi fan. Like, I really enjoyed, like, Old Man's War, but really didn't much care for Red Shirts and Fuzzy Nation. I was kind of fuzzy on.
I liked Fuzzy Nation, but it was, like, it's kind of not throwaway, but it was entertaining.
It's, like, very
Red
cutesy.
Shirts, yeah, it was cutesy. And Red Shirts, I do agree. I think it was a little indulgent.
Yes. And so I think it's nice. He's not doing Scalzi, right? Like, it's not the Scalzi voice. This is more like a mystery thriller with a little bit of science fiction. Like, I kind of compared it to more like Michael Crichton-y.
Oh, interesting.
That's good, actually.
Yeah, better writing than Michael Crichton, but, like, that kind of story, trying to appeal to that kind of audience as opposed to, like, trying to be super geek culture-y or trying to be super John Scalzi sardonic, you know, whatever blog.
Yep. The Scalzi voice.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, no, I liked it. So, last question, and then I will let you, I will let Anna sleep. And do you think Ancillary Sword will win awards, or at least receive nominations like Ancillary Justice did?
Ooh. That's interesting. I don't think it'll win the awards, to be frank. I do think it'll receive a good number of nominations, though.
I don't know. What else is there this year?
It's a good year. This is a good year for books. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think you look at, like, Scalzi has a book. And
Opera, which was really good. I think it could...
Which one?
Goblin Emperor, the one that we read.
Oh, yeah, that was fantastic. God, I hope so. That book is so good.
By the way, I'm starting a campaign for that book, and I know y'all will be on board. We're starting a campaign to get that book nominated for stuff.
We're definitely on board. And we want more of them. Wait, have there been sequels announced? There haven't, right?
No, it's a standalone.
I want more! Can we start that campaign?
I'm all in.
Okay.
Yeah,
that book, you know, Scalzi's book's going to get a lot of attention, obviously, at award time. I'm starting the Elizabeth Bear Range of Ghosts trilogy series as being nominated for a Hugo for the series.
Oh, interesting.
So if Wheel of Time can do it, she can do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Jeff Vandermeer has a new book out this year. You know, his trilogy, the Southern Reach trilogy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which will also be eligible as a trilogy under the Wheel of Time rule, or as an individual book.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's a strong year. You know, the question is whether or not Anne Leckie's name recognition, because I think the reality is, you know, whether the name and the publicity from Ancillary Justice will propel it into nominations. Because at the end of the day, we know a lot of these nominations are not based solely on merit, right? It's on buzz, it's on energy, it's on a lot of that stuff. And it's hard to build that buzz on a second book.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there's Mirror Empire as well, and City of Stairs.
Mm-hmm. So
I just cut through. Yeah. I think she might get some nominations. I don't know if she'll get the awards, but I think she will get the nominations. There was just too much. It was too successful. Ancillary Justice. It was too successful to just die out.
Yeah.
At this stage.
Plus, and it is a fantastic book.
Yeah, and I think that most of the reviews I've seen so far have been really, really positive.
Well, we will see. Well, this has been Anna Grillo and Thea James, the Book Smugglers, on Rocket Talk. Thank you both so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This has been Rocket Talk.